11. The odd asymmetry of the woman who looked like a giraffe and a stork continued to excite his memory. The combination of the flirtatious and the gawky, the very real sexual desire offset by the ironic smile, the vulgar conventionality of the flat and the originality of its owner. What would she be like when they made love? Try as he might, he could not picture it. He thought of nothing else for several days. The next time he answered her summons, the wine and two glasses stood waiting on the table. And this time everything went like clockwork. Before long, they were standing face to face in the bedroom, where the sun was setting on the birches in the painting, and kissing. But when he gave her his standard strip command, she not only failed to comply, but countermanded, "No. You first." Unaccustomed to such a response, he was somewhat taken aback. She started to open his fly. After ordering strip several more times, with comic failure, he was forced to accept a compromise. According to the rules of the game she had set up during his last visit, do as I do, she took off his trousers, he took off her skirt. Then she took off his shirt, he her blouse, until, at last, they stood there naked. He placed his hand on her moist genitals, then moved his fingers along to the anus, the spot he loved most in all women's bodies. Hers was unusually prominent, evoking the long digestive tract that ended there with a slight protrusion. Fingering her strong, healthy orb, that most splendid of rings called by doctors the sphincter, he suddenly felt her fingers on the corresponding part of his own anatomy. She was mimicking his moves with the precision of a mirror. Even though, as I have pointed out, he had known approximately 200 women, plus the considerable lot that had accrued during his days as a window washer, he had yet to be faced with a woman who was taller than he was, squinted at him, and fingered his anus. To overcome his embarrassment, he forced her down on the bed. So precipitous was his move that he caught her off guard. As her towering frame fell on its back, he caught among the red blotches on her face the frightened expression of equilibrium lost. Now that he was standing over her, he grabbed her under the knees and lifted her slightly parted legs in the air, so that they suddenly looked like the raised arms of a soldier surrendering to a gun pointed at him. Clumsiness combined with ardor, ardor with clumsiness. They excited Tomas utterly. He made love to her for a very long time, constantly scanning her red blotched face for that frightened expression of a woman who someone has tripped and who is falling, the inimitable expression that moments earlier had conveyed excitement to his brain. Then he went to wash in the bathroom. She followed him in and gave him long drawn-out explanations of where the soap was and where the sponge was and how to turn on the hot water. He was surprised that she went into such detail over such simple matters. At last he had to tell her that he understood everything perfectly and motioned to her to leave him alone in the bathroom. "Won't you let me stay and watch?" she begged. At last he managed to get her out. As he washed and urinated into the wash basin, standard procedure among Czech doctors, he had the feeling she was running back and forth outside the bathroom looking for a way to break in. When he turned off the water and the flat was suddenly silent, he felt he was being watched. He was nearly certain that there was a peephole somewhere in the bathroom door and that her beautiful eye was squinting through it. He went off in the best of moods, trying to fix her essence in his memory, to reduce that memory to a chemical formula capable of defining her uniqueness, her millionth part dissimilarity. The result was a formula consisting of three givens. 1. Clumsiness with ardor. 2. The frightened face of one who has lost her equilibrium and is falling. And 3. Legs raised in the air like the arms of a soldier surrendering to a pointed gun. Going over them, he felt the joy of having acquired yet another piece of the world, of having taken his imaginary scalpel and snipped yet another strip off the infinite canvas of the universe. 12. At about the same time, he had the following experience. He had been meeting a young woman in a room that an old friend put at his disposal every day until midnight. After a month or two, she reminded him of one of their early encounters. They had made love on a rug under the window while it was thundering and lightning outside. They had made love for the length of the storm. It had been unforgettably beautiful. Tomas was appalled. Yes, he remembered making love to her on the rug. His friend slept on a narrow couch that Tomas found uncomfortable. But he had completely forgotten the storm. It was odd. He could recall each of their times together. He had even kept close track of the ways they made love. She refused to be entered from behind. He remembered several of the things she had said during intercourse. She would ask him to squeeze her hips and to stop looking at her all the time. He even remembered the cut of her lingerie. But the storm had left no trace. Of each erotic experience, his memory recorded only the steep and narrow path of sexual conquest. The first piece of verbal aggression, the first touch, the first obscenity he said to her and she to him, the minor perversions he could make her acquiesce in, and the ones she held out against. All else he excluded, almost pedantically, from his memory. He even forgot where he had first seen one or another woman, if that event occurred before his sexual offensive began. The young woman smiled dreamily as she went on about the storm, and he looked at her in amazement and something akin to shame. She had experienced something beautiful, and he had failed to experience it with her. The two ways in which their memories reacted to the evening storm sharply delimit love and non-love. By the word non-love, I do not wish to imply that he took a cynical attitude to the young woman, that, as present-day parlance has it, he looked upon her as a sex object. On the contrary, he was quite fond of her, valued her character and intelligence, and was willing to come to her aid if ever she needed him. He was not the one who behaved shamefully towards her. It was his memory. For it was his memory that, unbeknown to him, had excluded her from the sphere of love. The brain appears to possess a special area which we might call poetic memory, and which records everything that charms or touches us, that makes our lives beautiful. From the time he met Teresa, no woman had the right to leave the slightest impression on that part of his brain. Teresa occupied his poetic memory like a despot and exterminated all trace of other women. That was unfair, because the young woman he made love to on the rug during the storm was not a bit less worthy of poetry than Teresa. She shouted, "Close your eyes, squeeze my hips, hold me tight." She could not stand it that when Tomas made love, he kept his eyes open, focused and observant, his body ever so slightly arched above her, never pressing against her skin. She did not want him to study her. She wanted to draw him into the magic stream that may be entered only with closed eyes. The reason she refused to get down on all fours was that in that position, their bodies did not touch at all, and he could observe her from a distance of several feet. She hated that distance. She wanted to merge with him. That is why, looking him straight in the eye, she insisted she had not had an orgasm, even though the rug was fairly dripping with it. "It's not sensual pleasure I'm after," she would say. "It's happiness. And pleasure without happiness is not pleasure." In other words, she was pounding on the gate of his poetic memory. But the gate was shut. There was no room for her in his poetic memory. There was room for her only on the rug. His adventure with Teresa began at the exact point where his adventures with other women left off. It took place on the other side of the imperative that pushed him into conquest after conquest. He had no desire to uncover anything in Teresa. She had come to him uncovered. He had made love to her before he could grab for the imaginary scalpel he used to open the prostrate body of the world. Before he could start wondering what she would be like when they made love, he loved her. Their love story did not begin until afterwards. She fell ill, and he was unable to send her home as he had the others. Kneeling by her as she lay sleeping in his bed, he realized that someone had sent her downstream in a bulrush basket. I have said before that metaphors are dangerous. Love begins with a metaphor, which is to say, love begins at the point when a woman enters her first word into our poetic memory. 13. Recently she had made another entry into his mind. Returning home with the milk one morning as usual, she stood in the doorway with a crow wrapped in her red scarf and pressed against her breast. It was the way gypsies held their babies. He would never forget it. The crow's enormous plaintive beak up next to her face. She had found it half buried, the way Cossacks used to dig their prisoners into the ground. "It was children," she said, and her words did more than state a fact. They revealed an unexpected repugnance for people in general. It reminded him of something she had said to him not long before. "I'm beginning to be grateful to you for not wanting to have children." And then she had complained to him about a man who had been bothering her at work. He had grabbed at a cheap necklace of hers and suggested that the only way she could have afforded it was by doing some prostitution on the side. She was very upset about it. More than necessary, thought Tomas. He suddenly felt dismayed at how little he had seen of her the last 2 years. He had so few opportunities to press her hands in his, to stop them from trembling. The next morning he had gone to work with Teresa on his mind. The woman who gave the window washers their assignments told him that a private customer had insisted on him personally. Tomas was not looking forward to it. He was afraid it was still another woman. Fully occupied with Teresa, he was in no mood for adventure. When the door opened, he gave a sigh of relief. He saw a tall, slightly stooped man before him. The man had a big chin and seemed vaguely familiar. "Come in," said the man with a smile, taking him inside. There was also a young man standing there. His face was bright red. He was looking at Tomas and trying to smile. "I assume there's no need for me to introduce you two," said the man. "No," said Tomas, and without returning the smile, he held out his hand to the young man. It was his son. Only then did the man with the big chin introduce himself. "I knew you looked familiar," said Tomas. "Of course, now I place you. It was the name that did it." They sat down at what was like a small conference table. Tomas realized that both men opposite him were his own involuntary creations. He had been forced to produce the younger one by his first wife, and the features of the older one had taken shape when he was under interrogation by the police. To clear his mind of these thoughts, he said, "Well, which window do you want me to start with?" Both men burst out laughing. Clearly, windows had nothing to do with the case. He had not been called in to do the windows. He had been lured into a trap. He had never before talked to his son. This was the first time he had shaken hands with him. He knew him only by sight and had no desire to know him any other way. As far as he was concerned, the less he knew about his son, the better, and he hoped the feeling was mutual. "Nice poster, isn't it?" said the editor, pointing at a large framed drawing on the wall opposite Tomas. Tomas now glanced around the room. The walls were hung with interesting pictures, mostly photographs and posters. The drawing the editor had singled out came from one of the last issues of his paper before the Russians closed it down in 1969. It was an imitation of a famous recruitment poster from the Russian Civil War of 1918, showing a soldier, red star on his cap, and extraordinarily stern look in his eyes, staring straight at you and aiming his index finger at you. The original Russian caption read, "Citizen, have you joined the Red Army?" It was replaced by a Czech text that read, "Citizen, have you signed the 2,000 words?" That was an excellent joke. The 2,000 words was the first glorious manifesto of the 1968 Prague Spring. It called for the radical democratization of the communist regime. First, it was signed by a number of intellectuals, and then other people came forward and asked to sign. And finally, there were so many signatures that no one could quite count them up. When the Red Army invaded their country and launched a series of political purges, one of the questions asked of each citizen was, "Have you signed the 2,000 words?" Anyone who admitted to having done so was summarily dismissed from his job. "A fine poster," said Tomas. "I remember it well." "Let's hope the Red Army isn't listening in on us," said the editor with a smile. Then he went on without the smile. "Seriously, though, this isn't my flat. It belongs to a friend. We can't be absolutely certain the police can hear us. It's only a possibility. If I'd invited you to my place, it would have been a certainty." Then he switched back to a playful tone. "But the way I look at it, we've got nothing to hide. And think of what a boon it will be to Czech historians of the future, the complete recorded lives of the Czech intelligentsia on file in the police archives. Do you know what effort literary historians have put into reconstructing in detail the sex lives of, say, Voltaire or Balzac or Tolstoy? No such problems with Czech writers. It's all on tape. Every last sigh." And turning to the imaginary microphones in the wall, he said in a stentorian voice, "Gentlemen, as always in such circumstances, I wish to take this opportunity to encourage you in your work and to thank you on my behalf and on behalf of all future historians." After the three of them had had a good laugh, the editor told the story of how his paper had been banned, what the artist who designed the poster was doing, and what had become of other Czech painters, philosophers, and writers. After the Russian invasion, they had been relieved of their positions and become window washers, parking attendants, night watchmen, boiler men in public buildings, or, at best, and usually with pull, taxi drivers. Although what the editor said was interesting enough, Tomas was unable to concentrate on it. He was thinking about his son. He remembered passing him in the street during the past 2 months. Apparently, these encounters had not been fortuitous. He had certainly never expected to find him in the company of a persecuted editor. Tomas's first wife was an Orthodox communist, and Tomas automatically assumed that his son was under her influence. He knew nothing about him. Of course, he could have come out and asked what kind of relationship he had with his mother, but he felt that it would be tactless in the presence of a third party. At last, the editor came to the point. He said that more and more people were going to prison for no offense other than upholding their own opinions, and concluded with the words, "And so we've decided to do something." "What is it you want to do?" asked Tomas. Here his son took over. It was the first time he had ever heard him speak. He was surprised to note that he stuttered. "According to our sources," he said, "political prisoners are being subjected to very rough treatment. Several are in a bad way, and so we've decided to draft a petition and have it signed by the most important Czech intellectuals, the ones who still mean something." No, it wasn't actually a stutter. It was more of a stammer, slowing down the flow of speech, stressing or highlighting every word he uttered, whether he wanted to or not. He obviously felt himself doing it, and his cheeks, which had barely regained their natural pallor, turned scarlet again. "And you've called me in for advice on likely candidates in my field?" Tomas asked. "No," the editor said, laughing. "We don't want your advice. We want your signature." And again he felt flattered. Again he enjoyed the feeling that he had not been forgotten as a surgeon. He protested, but only out of modesty. "Wait a minute. Just because they kicked me out doesn't mean I'm a famous doctor." "We haven't forgotten what you wrote for our paper," said the editor, smiling at Tomas. "Yes," sighed Tomas's son, with an alacrity Tomas may have missed. "I don't see how my name on a petition can help your political prisoners. Wouldn't it be better to have it signed by people who haven't fallen afoul of the regime? People who have at least some influence on the powers that be?" The editor smiled. "Of course it would." Tomas's son smiled too. He smiled the smile of one who understands many things. "The only trouble is they'd never sign." "Which doesn't mean we don't go after them," the editor continued. "Or that we're too nice to spare them the embarrassment," he laughed. "You should hear the excuses they give. They're fantastic." Tomas's son laughed in agreement. "Of course they all begin by claiming they agree with us right down the line," the editor said. "We just need a different approach," they say. "Something more prudent, more reasonable, more discreet. They're scared to sign and worried that if they don't, they'll sink in our estimation." Again, Tomas's son and the editor laughed together. Then the editor gave Tomas a sheet of paper with a short text, calling upon the President of the Republic, in a relatively respectful manner, to grant amnesty to all political prisoners. Tomas ran the idea quickly through his mind. Amnesty to political prisoners? Would amnesty be granted because people jettisoned by the regime, and therefore themselves potential political prisoners, requested of the President? The only thing such a petition would accomplish was to keep political prisoners from being amnestied if there happened to be a plan afoot to do so. His son interrupted his thoughts. "The main thing is to make the point that there are still a handful of people in this country who are not afraid, and to show who stands where. Separate the wheat from the chaff." True, true, thought Tomas. But what had that to do with political prisoners? Either you called for an amnesty, or you separated the wheat from the chaff. The two were not identical. "On the fence?" the editor asked. Yes, he was on the fence, but he was afraid to say so. There was a picture on the wall, a picture of a soldier pointing a threatening finger at him, saying, "Are you hesitating about joining the Red Army?" Or, "Haven't you signed the 2,000 words yet?" Or, "Have you too signed the 2,000 words? Or, you mean you don't want to sign the amnesty petition?" But no matter what the soldier said, it was a threat. The editor had barely finished saying what he thought about people who agree that the political prisoners should be granted amnesty, but come up with thousands of reasons against signing the petition. In his opinion, their reasons were just so many excuses, and their excuses a smokescreen for cowardice. What could Tomas say? At last he broke the silence with a laugh, and pointing to the poster on the wall, he said, "With that soldier threatening me, asking whether I'm going to sign or not, I can't possibly think straight." Then all three laughed for a while. "All right," said Tomas after the laughter had died down. "I'll think it over. Can we get together again in the next few days?" "Any time at all," said the editor. "But unfortunately, the petition can't wait. We plan to get it off to the president tomorrow." Tomorrow? And suddenly Tomas recalled the portly policeman, handing him the denunciation of none other than the tall editor with a big chin. Everyone was trying to make him sign statements he had not written himself. "There's nothing to think over, anyway," said his son. Although his words were aggressive, his intonation bordered on the supplicatory. Now that they were looking each other in the eye, Tomas noticed that when concentrating, the boy slightly raised the left side of his upper lip. It was an expression he saw on his own face whenever he peered into the mirror to determine whether it was clean-shaven. Discovering it on the face of another made him uneasy. When parents live with their children through childhood, they grow accustomed to that kind of similarity. It seems trivial to them, or, if they stop and think about it, amusing. But Tomas was talking to his son for the first time in his life. He was not used to sitting face to face with his own asymmetrical mouth. Imagine having an arm amputated and implanted on someone else. Imagine that person sitting opposite you and gesticulating with it in your face. You would stare at that arm as at a ghost. Even though it was your own personal, beloved arm, you would be horrified at the possibility of its touching you. "Aren't you on the side of the persecuted?" his son added, and Tomas suddenly saw that what was really at stake in this scene they were playing was not the amnesty of political prisoners. It was his relationship with his son. If he signed, their fates would be united, and Tomas would be more or less obliged to befriend him. If he failed to sign, their relations would remain null as before, though now not so much by his own will as by the will of his son, who would renounce his father for his cowardice. He was in the situation of a chess player who cannot avoid checkmate and is forced to resign. Whether he signed the petition or not made not the slightest difference. It would alter nothing in his own life or in the lives of the political prisoners. "Hand it over," he said, and took the sheet of paper. 14. As if rewarding him for his decision, the editor said, "That was a fine piece you wrote about Oedipus." Handing him a pen, his son added, Some ideas have the force of a bomb exploding." Although the editor's words of praise pleased him, his son's metaphor struck him as forced and out of place. "Unfortunately, I was the only casualty," he said. "Thanks to those ideas, I can no longer operate on my patients." It sounded cold, almost hostile. Apparently hoping to counteract the discordant note, the editor said, by way of apology, "But think of all the people your article helped." From childhood, Tomas had associated the words "helping people" with one thing and one thing only: medicine. How could an article help people? What were these two trying to make him swallow, reducing his whole life to a single small idea about Oedipus, or even less, to a single primitive no in the face of the regime? "Maybe it helped people, maybe it didn't," he said, in a voice still cold, though he probably did not realize it. "But as a surgeon, I know I saved a few lives." Another silence set in. Tomas's son broke it. "Ideas can save lives, too." Watching his own mouth in the boy's face, Tomas thought, how strange to see one's own lips stammer. "You know the best thing about what you wrote?" the boy went on, and Tomas could see the effort it cost him to speak. "Your refusal to compromise, your clear-cut sense of what's good and what's evil, something we're beginning to lose. We have no idea anymore what it means to feel guilty. The communists have the excuse that Stalin misled them. Murderers have the excuse that their mothers didn't love them. And suddenly you come out and say, there is no excuse. No one could be more innocent in his soul and conscience than Oedipus. And yet he punished himself when he saw what he had done." Tomas tore his eyes away from his son's mouth and tried to focus on the editor. He was irritated and felt like arguing with him. "But it's all a misunderstanding. The border between good and evil is terribly fuzzy. I wasn't out to punish anyone either. Punishing people who don't know what they've done is barbaric. The myth of Oedipus is a beautiful one, but treating it like this..." He had more to say, but suddenly he remembered that the place might be bugged. He had not the slightest ambition to be quoted by historians of centuries to come. He was simply afraid of being quoted by the police. Wasn't that what they wanted from him, after all? A condemnation of the article? He did not like the idea of feeding it to them from his own lips. Besides, he knew that anything anyone in the country said could be broadcast over the radio at any time. He held his tongue.
"I wonder what's made you change your mind," said the editor.
"What I wonder is what made me write the thing in the first place," said Tomas. And just then he remembered. She had landed at his bedside like a child sent downstream in a bulrush basket. Yes, that was why he had picked up the book and gone back to the stories of Romulus, Moses, and Oedipus. And now she was with him again. He saw her pressing the crow wrapped in red to her breast. The image of her brought him peace. It seemed to tell him that Teresa was alive, that she was with him in the same city, and that nothing else counted. This time the editor broke the silence.
"I understand. I don't like the idea of punishment either. After all," he added, smiling, "we don't call for punishment to be inflicted. We call for it to cease."
"I know," said Tomas. In the next few moments he would do something possibly noble but certainly and totally useless, because it would not help the political prisoners, and unpleasant to himself, because it took place under conditions the two of them had imposed on him. "It's your duty to sign," his son added, almost pleading.
Duty? His son reminding him of his duty. That was the worst word anyone could have used on him. Once more, the image of Teresa appeared before his eyes, Teresa holding the crow in her arms. Then he remembered that she had been accosted by an undercover agent the day before. Her hands had started trembling again. She had aged. She was all that mattered to him. She, born of 6 fortuities. She, the blossom sprung from the chief surgeon's sciatica. She, the reverse side of all his Es muss sein. She was the only thing he cared about. Why even think about whether to sign or not? There was only one criterion for all his decisions. He must do nothing that could harm her. Tomas could not save political prisoners, but he could make Teresa happy. He could not really succeed in doing even that, but if he signed the petition, he could be fairly certain that she would have more frequent visits from undercover agents and that her hands would tremble more and more.
"It is much more important to dig a half-buried crow out of the ground," he said, "than to send petitions to a president."
He knew that his words were incomprehensible, but enjoyed them all the more for it. He felt a sudden, unexpected intoxication come over him. It was the same black intoxication he had felt when he solemnly announced to his wife that he no longer wished to see her or his son. It was the same black intoxication he had felt when he sent off the letter that meant the end of his career in medicine. He was not at all sure he was doing the right thing, but he was sure he was doing what he wanted to do.
"I'm sorry," he said, "but I'm not going to sign."
15. Several days later he read about the petition in the papers. There was not a word, of course, about its being a politely worded plea for the release of political prisoners. None of the papers cited a single sentence from the short text. Instead they went on at great length and in vague, menacing terms about an anti-state proclamation meant to lay the foundation for a new campaign against socialism. They also listed all the signatories, accompanying each of their names with slanderous attacks that gave Tomas goose flesh. Not that it was unexpected. The fact that any public undertaking, meeting, petition, street gathering, not organized by the Communist Party, was automatically considered illegal and endangered all the participants, was common knowledge. But it may have made him sorrier he had not signed the petition. Why hadn't he signed? He could no longer quite remember what had prompted his decision. And once more I see him the way he appeared to me at the very beginning of the novel, standing at the window and staring across the courtyard at the walls opposite. This is the image from which he was born. As I have pointed out before, characters are not born like people,
of woman. They're born of a situation, a sentence, a metaphor, containing, in a nutshell, a basic human possibility that the author thinks no one else has discovered or said something essential about. But isn't it true that an author can write only about himself? Staring impotently across a courtyard, at a loss for what to do, hearing the pertinacious rumbling of one's own stomach during a moment of love, betraying, yet lacking the will to abandon the glamorous path of betrayal, raising one's fist with the crowds in the grand march, displaying one's wit before hidden microphones. I have known all these situations. I have experienced them myself. Yet none of them has given rise to the person my curriculum vitae and I represent. The characters in my novels are my own unrealized possibilities. That is why I am equally fond of them all and equally horrified by them. Each one has crossed a border that I myself have circumvented. It is that crossed border, the border beyond which my own I ends, which attracts me most. For beyond that border begins the secret the novel asks about. The novel is not the author's confession. It is an investigation of human life in the trap the world has become. But enough. Let us return to Tomas. Alone in his flat, he stared across the courtyard at the dirty walls of the building opposite. He missed the tall, stooped man with the big chin and the man's friends, whom he did not know, who were not even members of his circle. He felt as though he had just met a beautiful woman on a railway platform. And before he could say anything to her, she had stepped into a sleeping car on its way to Istanbul or Lisbon. Then he tried again to think through what he should have done. Even though he did his best to put aside everything belonging to the realm of the emotions, the admiration he had for the editor and the irritation his son caused him, he was still not sure whether he ought to have signed the text they gave him. Is it right to raise one's voice when others are being silenced? Yes. On the other hand, why did the papers devote so much space to the petition? After all, the press, totally manipulated by the state, could have kept it quiet and no one would have been the wiser. If they publicized the petition, then the petition played into the ruler's hands. It was manna from heaven, the perfect start and justification for a new wave of persecution. What then should he have done, sign or not? Another way of formulating the question is it better to shout and thereby hasten the end, or to keep silent and gain thereby a slower death? Is there any answer to these questions? And again he thought the thought we already know. Human life occurs only once, and the reason we cannot determine which of our decisions are good and which bad is that in a given situation we can only make one decision. We are not granted a second, third, or fourth life in which to compare various decisions. History is similar to individual lives in this respect. There is only one history of the Czechs. One day it will come to an end, as surely as Tomas's life, never to be repeated. In 1618, the Czech estates took courage and vented their ire on the emperor reigning in Vienna by pitching two of his high officials out of a window in the Prague castle. Their defiance led to the 30 Years' War, which in turn led to the almost complete destruction of the Czech nation. Should the Czechs have shown more caution than courage? The answer may seem simple. It is not. 320 years later, after the Munich Conference of 1938, the entire world decided to sacrifice the Czechs' country to Hitler. Should the Czechs have tried to stand up to a power 8 times their size? In contrast to 1618, they opted for caution. Their capitulation led to the Second World War, which in turn led to the forfeit of their nation's freedom for many decades, or even centuries. Should they have shown more courage than caution? What should they have done? If Czech history could be repeated, we should, of course, find it desirable to test the other possibility each time and compare the results. Without such an experiment, all considerations of this kind remained a game of hypotheses. Einmal ist keinmal. What happens but once might as well not have happened at all. The history of the Czechs will not be repeated, nor will the history of Europe. The history of the Czechs and of Europe is a pair of sketches from the pen of mankind's fateful inexperience. History is as light as an individual human life, unbearably light, light as a feather, as dust swirling into the air, as whatever will no longer exist tomorrow. Once more, and with a nostalgia akin to love, Tomas thought of the tall, stooped editor. That man acted as though history were a finished picture rather than a sketch. He acted as though everything he did were to be repeated endlessly, to return eternally, without the slightest doubt about his actions. He was convinced he was right, and for him that was a sign not of narrow-mindedness, but of virtue. Yes, that man lived in a different history than Tomas's, a history that was not, or did not realize it was, a sketch. 16. Several days later, he was struck by another thought, which I record here as an addendum to the preceding chapter. Somewhere out in space there was a planet where all people would be born again. They would be fully aware of the life they had spent on Earth and of all the experience they had amassed there. And perhaps there was still another planet, where we would all be born a third time with the experience of our first two lives. And perhaps there were yet more and more planets where mankind would be born one degree, one life more mature. That was Tomas's version of eternal return. Of course, we here on Earth, planet number one, the planet of inexperience, can only fabricate vague fantasies of what will happen to man on those other planets. Will he be wiser? Is maturity within man's power? Can he attain it through repetition? Only from the perspective of such a utopia is it possible to use the concepts of pessimism and optimism with full justification. An optimist is someone who thinks that on planet number five, the history of mankind will be less bloody. A pessimist is one who thinks otherwise. 17. One of Jules Verne's famous novels, a favorite of Tomas's in his childhood, is called 2 Years on Holiday, and indeed, 2 years is the maximum. Tomas was in his third year as a window washer. In the last few weeks, he had come to realize, half sadly, half laughing to himself, that he had grown physically tired. He had one, sometimes two, erotic engagements a day, and that although he had not lost his zest for women, he found himself straining his forces to the utmost. Let me add that the strain was on his physical, not his sexual powers. His problem was with his breath, not with his penis, a state of affairs that had its comical side. One day he was having trouble reaching a prospect for his afternoon time slot, and it looked as though he was going to have one of his rare off days. He was desperate. He had phoned a certain young woman about 10 times, a charming acting student whose body had been tanned on Yugoslavia's nudist beaches with an evenness that called to mind slow rotation on a mechanized spit. After making one last call from his final job of the day and starting back to the office at 4 to hand in his signed order slips, he was stopped in the center of Prague by a woman he failed to recognize. "Wherever have you disappeared to? I haven't seen you in ages." Tomas racked his brains to place her. Had she been one of his patients? She was behaving like an intimate friend. He tried to answer in a manner that would conceal the fact that he did not recognize her. He was already thinking about how to lure her to his friend's flat. He had the key in his pocket, when he realized from a chance remark who the woman was. The budding actress with the perfect tan, the one he had been trying to reach all day. This episode both amused and horrified him. It proved that he was as tired mentally as physically. 2 years of holiday could not be extended indefinitely. 18. The holiday from the operating table was also a holiday from Teresa. After hardly seeing each other for 6 days, they would finally be together on Sundays, full of desire. But as on the evening when Tomas came back from Zurich, they were estranged and had a long way to go before they could touch and kiss. Physical love gave them pleasure, but no consolation. She no longer cried out as she had in the past, and at the moment of orgasm, her grimace seemed to him to express suffering and a strange absence. Only at night, in sleep, were they tenderly united. Holding his hand, she would forget the chasm of daylight that divided them. But the nights gave him neither the time nor the means to protect and take care of her. In the mornings, it was heartrending to see her, and he feared for her. She looked sad and infirm. One Sunday, she asked him to take her for a ride outside Prague. They drove to a spa, where they found all the streets relabeled with Russian names, and happened to meet an old patient of Tomas's. Tomas was devastated by the meeting. Suddenly, here was someone talking to him again as to a doctor, and he could feel his former life bridging the divide, coming back to him with its pleasant regularity of seeing patients and feeling their trusting eyes on him, those eyes he had pretended to ignore, but in fact savored and now greatly missed. Driving home, Tomas pondered the catastrophic mistake he had made by returning to Prague from Zurich. He kept his eyes trained on the road so as to avoid looking at Teresa. He was furious with her. Her presence at his side felt more unbearably fortuitous than ever. What was she doing here next to him? Who put her in the basket and sent her downstream? Why was his bed chosen as her shore? And why she, and not some other woman? Neither of them said a word the whole way. When they got home, they had dinner in silence. Silence lay between them like an agony. It grew heavier by the minute. To escape it, they went straight to bed. He woke in the middle of the night. She was crying. "I was buried," she told him. "I'd been buried for a long time. You came to see me every week. Each time you knocked at the grave and I came out, my eyes were full of dirt. You'd say, 'How can you see?' and try to wipe the dirt from my eyes. And I'd say, 'I can't see anyway. I have holes instead of eyes.' And then one day you went off on a long journey, and I knew you were there with another woman. Weeks passed and there was no sign of you. I was afraid of missing you and stopped sleeping. At last, you knocked at the grave again. But I was so worn down by a month of sleepless nights that I didn't think I could make it out of there. When I finally did come out, you seemed disappointed. You said I didn't look well. I could feel how awful I looked to you with my sunken cheeks and nervous gestures. 'I'm sorry,' I apologized. 'I haven't slept a wink since you left.' 'You see,' you said in a voice full of false cheer, 'what you need is a good rest, a month's holiday.' As if I didn't know what you had in mind. A month's holiday meant you didn't want to see me for a month. You had another woman. Then you left and I slipped down into my grave, knowing full well that I'd have another month of sleepless nights waiting for you, and that when you came back and I was uglier, you'd be even more disappointed." He had never heard anything more harrowing. Holding her tightly in his arms and feeling her body tremble, he thought he could not endure his love. Let the planet be convulsed with exploding bombs, the country ravished daily by new hordes, all his neighbors taken out and shot. He could accept it all more easily than he dared admit. But the grief implicit in Teresa's dream was something he could not endure. He tried to re-enter the dream she had told him. He pictured himself stroking her face and delicately, she mustn't be aware of it, brushing the dirt out of her eye sockets. Then he heard her say the unbelievably harrowing, "I can't see anyway. I have holes instead of eyes." His heart was about to break. He felt he was on the verge of a heart attack. Teresa had gone back to sleep. He could not. He pictured her death. She was dead and having terrible nightmares, but because she was dead, he was unable to wake her from them. Yes, that is death. Teresa asleep, having terrible nightmares, and he unable to wake her. 19. During the 5 years that had passed since the Russian army invaded Tomas's country, Prague had undergone considerable changes. The people Tomas met in the streets were different. Half of his friends had emigrated, and half of the half that remained had died. For it is a fact which will go unrecorded by historians that the years following the Russian invasion were a period of funerals. The death rate soared. I do not speak only of the cases, rather rare, of course, of people hounded to death, like Jan Prochaska, the novelist. 2 weeks after his private conversations were broadcast daily over the radio, he entered the hospital. The cancer that had most likely lain dormant in his body until then suddenly blossomed like a rose. He was operated on in the presence of the police, who, when they realized he was doomed anyway, lost interest in him and let him die in the arms of his wife. But many also died without being directly subjected to persecution. The hopelessness pervading the entire country penetrated the soul to the body, shattering the latter. Some ran desperately from the favor of a regime that wanted to endow them with the honor of displaying them side by side with its new leaders. That is how the poet František Hrubin died, fleeing from the love of the party. The Minister of Culture, from whom the poet did everything possible to hide, did not catch up with Hrubin until his funeral, when he made a speech over the grave about the poet's love for the Soviet Union. Perhaps he hoped his words would ring so outrageously false that they would wake Hrubin from the dead. But the world was too ugly, and no one decided to rise up out of the grave. One day, Tomas went to the crematorium to attend the funeral of a famous biologist who had been thrown out of the university and the Academy of Sciences. The authorities had forbidden mention of the hour of the funeral in the death announcement, fearing that the services would turn into a demonstration. The mourners themselves did not learn until the last moment that the body would be cremated at 6:30 in the morning. Entering the crematorium, Tomas did not understand what was happening. The hall was lit up like a film studio. Looking around in bewilderment, he noticed cameras set up in 3 places. No, it was not television. It was the police. They were filming the funeral to study who had attended it. An old colleague of the dead scientist, still a member of the Academy of Sciences, had been brave enough to make the funeral oration. He had never counted on becoming a film star. When the services were over and everyone had paid his respects to the family of the deceased, Tomas noticed a group of men in one corner of the hall and spotted the tall, stooped editor among them. The sight of him made Tomas feel how much he missed these people who feared nothing and seemed bound by a deep friendship. He started off in the editor's direction with a smile and a greeting on his lips, but when the editor saw him, he said, "Careful. Don't come any closer." It was a strange thing to say. Tomas was not sure whether to interpret it as a sincere, friendly warning. Watch out, we're being filmed. If you talk to us, you may be hauled in for another interrogation. Or as irony. If you weren't brave enough to sign the petition, be consistent, and don't try the old pals act on us. Whatever the message meant, Tomas heeded it and moved off. He had the feeling that the beautiful woman on the railway platform had not only stepped into the sleeping car, but, just as he was about to tell her how much he admired her, had put her finger over his lips and forbidden him to speak. 20. That afternoon he had another interesting encounter. He was washing the display window of a large shoe shop when a young man came to a halt right next to him, leaned up close to the window, and began scrutinizing the prices.
"Prices are up," said Tomas, without interrupting his pursuit of the rivulets trickling down the glass. The man looked over at him. He was a hospital colleague of Tomas's, the one I have designated S, the one who had sneered at Tomas while under the impression that Tomas had written a statement of self-criticism. Tomas was delighted to see him, naively so, as we delight in unexpected events. But what he saw in his former colleague's eyes, before S had a chance to pull himself together, was a look of none too pleasant surprise.
"How are you?" S asked. Before Tomas could respond, he realized that S was ashamed of having asked. It was patently ridiculous for a doctor practicing his profession to ask a doctor washing windows how he was. To clear the air, Tomas came out with as sprightly a "fine, just fine," as he could muster. But he immediately felt that no matter how hard he tried, in fact, because he tried so hard, his "fine" sounded bitterly ironic, and so he quickly added, "What's new at the hospital?"
"Nothing," S answered. "Same as always."
His response, too, though meant to be as neutral as possible, was completely inappropriate, and they both knew it. And they knew they both knew it. How can things be the same as always when one of them is washing windows?
"How's the chief?" asked Tomas.
"You mean you don't see him?" asked S.
"No," said Tomas.
It was true. From the day he left, he had not seen the chief surgeon even once. And they had worked so well together. They had even tended to think of themselves as friends. So no matter how he said it, his no had a sad ring, and Tomas suspected that S was angry with him for bringing up the subject. Like the chief surgeon, S had never dropped by to ask Tomas how he was doing, or whether he needed anything. All conversation between the two former colleagues had become impossible, even though they both regretted it, Tomas especially. He was not angry with his colleagues for having forgotten him. If only he could make that clear to the young man beside him. What he really wanted to say was, "There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's perfectly normal for our paths not to cross. There's nothing to get upset about. I'm glad to see you." But he was afraid to say it, because everything he had said so far failed to come out as intended, and these sincere words, too, would sound sarcastic to his colleague. "I'm sorry," said S, after a long pause. "I'm in a real hurry." He held out his hand. "I'll give you a buzz." During the period when his colleagues turned their noses up at him for his supposed cowardice, they all smiled at him. Now that they could no longer scorn him, now that they were constrained to respect him, they gave him a wide berth. Then again, even his old patients had stopped sending for him, to say nothing of greeting him with champagne. The situation of the déclassé intellectual was no longer exceptional. It had turned into something permanent and unpleasant to confront. 21. He went home, lay down, and fell asleep earlier than usual. An hour later, he woke up with stomach pains. They were an old malady that appeared whenever he was depressed. He opened the medicine chest and let out a curse. It was completely empty. He had forgotten to keep it stocked. He tried to keep the pain under control by force of will and was, in fact, fairly successful. But he could not fall asleep again.
When Teresa came home at 1:30, he felt like chatting with her.
He told her about the funeral, about the editor's refusal to talk to him, and about his encounter with S.
"Prague has grown so ugly lately," said Teresa.
"I know," said Tomas.
Teresa paused and said softly, "The best thing to do would be to move away."
"I agree," said Tomas, "but there's nowhere to go."
He was sitting on the bed in his pajamas, and she came and sat down next to him, putting her arms around his body from the side.
"What about the country?" she said.
"The country?" he asked, surprised.
"We'd be alone there. You wouldn't meet that editor or your old colleagues. The people there are different. And we'd be getting back to nature. Nature is the same as it always was. Just then Tomas felt another stab in his stomach. It made him feel old, feel that what he longed for more than anything else was peace and quiet.
"Maybe you're right," he said with difficulty. The pain made it hard for him to breathe.
"We'd have a little house and a little garden, but big enough to give Karenin room for a decent run."
"Yes," said Tomas.
He was trying to picture what it would be like if they did move to the country. He would have difficulty finding a new woman every week. It would mean an end to his erotic adventures. "The only thing is, you'd be bored with me in the country," said Teresa, as if reading his mind. The pain grew more intense. He could not speak. It occurred to him that his womanizing was also something of an es muss sein, an imperative enslaving him. He longed for a holiday. But for an absolute holiday, a rest from all imperatives, from all es muss sein. If he could take a rest, a permanent rest from the hospital operating table, then why not from the world operating table, the one where his imaginary scalpel opened the strong box women use to hide their illusory one millionth part dissimilarity? "Your stomach is acting up again," Teresa exclaimed, only then realizing that something was wrong. He nodded. "Have you had your injection?" He shook his head. "I forgot to lay in a supply of medication." Though annoyed at his carelessness, she stroked his forehead, which was beaded with sweat from the pain. "I feel a little better now." "Lie down," she said, and covered him with a blanket. She went off to the bathroom and in a minute was back, lying next to him. Without lifting his head from the pillow, he turned to her and nearly gasped. The grief burning in her eyes was unbearable. "Tell me, Teresa, what's wrong? Something's been going on inside you lately. I can feel it. I know it." "No," she shook her head. "There's nothing wrong."
"There's no point denying it."
"It's still the same things," she said. The same things meant her jealousy and his infidelities. But Tomas would not let up. "No, Teresa, this time it's something different. It's never been this bad before." "Well, then, I'll tell you," she said. "Go and wash your hair." He did not understand. The tone of her explanation was sad, unantagonistic, almost gentle. "For months now, your hair has had a strong odor to it. It smells of female genitals. I didn't want to tell you, but night after night I've had to breathe in the groin of some mistress of yours."
The moment she finished, his stomach began hurting again. He was desperate. The scrubbings he put himself through, body, hands, face, to make sure not the slightest trace of their odors remained behind. He'd even avoided their fragrant soaps, carrying his own harsh variety with him at all times. But he'd forgotten about his hair. It had never occurred to him.
Then he remembered the woman who had straddled his face and wanted him to make love to her with it and with the crown of his head. He hated her now. What stupid ideas! He saw there was no use denying it. All he could do was laugh a silly laugh and head for the bathroom to wash his hair. But she stroked his forehead again and said, "Stay here in bed. Don't bother washing it out. I'm used to it by now." His stomach was killing him, and he longed for peace and quiet.
"I'll write to that patient of mine, the one we met at the spa. Do you know the district where his village is?"
"No." Tomas was having great trouble talking. All he could say was, "Woods, rolling hills." "That's right. That's what we'll do. We'll go away from here, but no talking now." And she kept stroking his forehead. They lay there side by side, neither saying a word. Slowly the pain began to recede. Soon they were both asleep. 22. In the middle of the night, he woke up and realized, to his surprise, that he had been having one erotic dream after another.
The only one he could recall with any clarity was the last, an enormous naked woman, at least 5 times his size, floating on her back in a pool, her belly from crotch to navel covered with thick hair. Looking at her from the side of the pool, he was greatly excited. How could he have been excited when his body was debilitated by a gastric disorder? And how could he be excited by the sight of a woman who would have repelled him had he seen her while conscious? He thought. In the clockwork of the head, 2 cogwheels turn opposite each other. On the one, images. On the other, the body's reactions. The cog carrying the image of a naked woman meshes with the corresponding erection command cog. But when, for one reason or another, the wheels go out of phase and the excitement cog meshes with a cog bearing the image of a swallow in flight, the penis rises at the sight of a swallow. Moreover, a study by one of Tomas's colleagues, a specialist in human sleep, claimed that during any kind of dream men have erections, which means that the link between erections and naked women is only one of 1,000 ways the Creator can set the clockwork moving in a man's head. And what has love in common with all this? Nothing. If a cogwheel in Tomas's head goes out of phase, and he is excited by seeing a swallow, it has absolutely no effect on his love for Teresa. If excitement is a mechanism our Creator uses for his own amusement, love is something that belongs to us alone and enables us to flee the Creator. Love is our freedom. Love lies beyond Es muss sein. Though that is not entirely true, even if love is something other than a clockwork of sex that the Creator uses for his own amusement, it is still attached to it. It is attached to it like a tender, naked woman to the pendulum of an enormous clock. Tomas thought, attaching love to sex is one of the most bizarre ideas the Creator ever had. He also thought, one way of saving love from the stupidity of sex would be to set the clockwork in our head in such a way as to excite us at the sight of a swallow. And with that sweet thought, he started dozing off. But on the very threshold of sleep, in the no man's land of muddled concepts, he was suddenly certain he had just discovered the solution to all riddles, the key to all mysteries, a new utopia, a paradise. A world where man is excited by seeing a swallow, and Tomas can love Teresa without being disturbed by the aggressive stupidity of sex. Then he fell asleep.